Rapp was still trying to absorb what lesson there was to learn from his earlier throwdown with the man whose name he still did not know. He wasn't happy that the man had changed his own rules in the middle of a fight, but there wasn't a lot he could do about it now. He had to focus on how it would affect things going forward. It was important to know how far he could push it, and if these instructors weren't going to abide by the rules, they could hardly expect him to do so. Rapp's first chance to meet the other men was after his run. They were at the pull-up bars behind the barn doing 4 sets of 25. In addition to the mean old bastard running the place, there were 3 more instructors. Just as his recruiter had told him, no one was to use his real name or discuss any personal information. The first 2 instructors were easy to keep straight. The short, skinny one was called Sergeant Smith, and the tall, skinny one was called Sergeant Jones. They would start their days with Smith and end with Jones. Rapp had to do 2 sets of 25 with a 30-second rest between so he could catch up with the other recruits. After each man had polished off a full 100 pull-ups, Sergeant Smith went nuts. He lined them up and paced back and forth, dumping disdain on them. "One of you faggots doesn't think he needs to do a full pull-up," the instructor started. "Thinks he can go halfway down and not quite all the way up. Well, I don't like anything done half-ass, so you ladies get to start over." Then the invective really started to fly as he called into question their manhood, honor, intelligence, and lineage. Rapp noted that he treated them as a group rather than singling out the supposed offender, who he wasn't so sure even existed. He'd watched the other men, and none of them seemed to be slacking off. The sergeant was simply moving the goal line in hopes that one of them would grow sick of the games and quit. As he looked around, though, he didn't see that happening. The other 6 were hard individuals.
4 more sets on the quick. Let's go," the sergeant barked. "And do 'em right this time, or I'll send you ladies on a nice long run, and you can forget about dinner."
There were 2 bars, so the men lined up and started over. Rapp was waiting for his turn when one of the other recruits poked him hard in the kidney. Rapp turned around and took inventory of the man who had jabbed him and was now cussing him out in a voice only the 2 of them could hear. The man looked like one of those professional rugby players from Europe. He had a heavy brow made heavier by a single black eyebrow that traveled laterally from one temple to the other. His eyes were coal black and wide-set, but his most prominent features were a hooked nose that looked to have been broken at least 2 times and a dimple in the middle of his pronounced chin. Rapp thought of 2 things almost instantly. The first was that it would be a waste of effort to try to knock him out with a punch to the head. The guy's neck was as thick as the average man's thigh. The second was that he didn't fit in. At least as far as Rapp understood the intent of what they were up to, the man's features were so distinctive as to make him almost impossible to forget. He looked more like an enforcer than a stealth operative. "Do him right this time, shithead," the big man said testily. Rapp was sweaty, dirty, hot as hell, and not used to taking crap from anyone. He had done his pull-ups correctly. If anyone could be accused of not doing them all the way, it would be the very man who was in his face. Rapp was tempted to set the tone and knock the guy on his ass, but he figured there would be plenty of time for that later. He turned back around without responding and stepped to the line. "That's right," the big man said. "Be a smart boy and keep your mouth shut. Just fucking do 'em right this time." The rest of the afternoon proceeded without incident, and they were allowed to jump into the lake to cool down before dinner. Rapp steered clear of Victor, but kept an eye on him. He had learned that was the big man's name, or at least the name he'd been given. Since they were forbidden to use their real names, the instructors gave each of them a fake first name. Rapp's was Irving, which they had already shortened to Irv. The other 5 guys were Fred, Roy, Glenn, Bill, and Dick. They all seemed decent enough and pretty much kept their heads down and their eyes alert. There were a lot of knowing glances and silent communication. Since they were forbidden to talk about their past, there was no mention of military service at the units they had served in. This created an interesting situation for Rapp. The instructors more than likely knew he'd never served in the military, but the other recruits had no idea. It created a weird dynamic when you dumped a group of guys in a situation where they were forbidden to talk about their pasts. It pretty much killed small talk, so little was said during dinner. Rapp retired to his cot so he could ice his groin, and was staring up at the slow, churning revolutions of the ceiling fan that hung from the rafters directly above him. He was thinking about the match, going through it move by move, wondering what he could have done differently, when Victor appeared next to his cot. "What's your name?" he asked in a hushed voice. Rapp glanced over to the door, where one of the instructors was giving orders to one of the other guys. "Irv." "No, dumbass," he shook his head. "I mean your real name." Rapp was starting to think he didn't like Victor. He'd been warned by his recruiter repeatedly that talking about your personal life was grounds for immediate dismissal from the program. Just 10 minutes earlier, while they were eating, the instructors had reminded them of this again. Rapp impassively looked up and said, "Didn't you hear what the instructors told us?" A lopsided grin fell across the other man's face. "That's just a bunch of BS. It's a game. They're just trying to fuck with us." He glanced over his shoulder to make sure no one was close enough to hear and said, "Come on. Where are you from?" "What's your angle?" "Huh? What are you up to?" "Just trying to get to know the guys, that's all." "Try not to take this the wrong way, but it's none of your business who I am or where I'm from." "Is that so?" His face flushed a bit and his jaw tightened. "I'll tell you something. I don't need you telling me what he is and isn't my business." Rep didn't like his predicament. He was on his back and vulnerable, but he didn't want Victor to think he was easily intimidated. "It's not me telling you," he said in a casual voice. "It's them." Rapp looked over at the instructor by the door. The instructor finished whatever he was saying and left. It was just the 7 recruits now. Victor started laughing. "There goes your mother. Looks like your ass is mine." Rapp decided lying down was no longer the best position to be in. He quickly swung his legs off the cot and stood. In a conversational tone that was loud enough for the others to hear, he said, "What's your problem, Victor?"
"You're my problem."
"I gathered that," Rapp said from the other side of the cot. "But could you be a little more specific? Maybe it's something I could fix."
"I doubt it," the bigger man said with disdain. "You look soft to me, like you don't belong here."
"Well, why don't we find out?" Rapp gestured to the wrestling mat. Victor laughed as if the idea was preposterous.
"You don't stand a chance."
Rapp nodded, as if to say, maybe, maybe not, and walked over to the edge of the mat. "I'm sorry about your mother, Victor."
"What did you just say?"
Victor asked. "I said," Rapp half-yelled, "I'm sorry about your mom."
"You better watch yourself."
Victor's eyes had taken on a wild glare. "Or what?" Rapp asked. The other 5 guys all dropped what they were doing to see what was going on.
"You going to take a swing at me, Victor?"
Rapp egged the big man on. He was ready to end this thing right now. "What's wrong? Your mom, the neighborhood slut when you were growing up, she didn't hold you enough when you were little? She let every guy she met suck on her tit except you?"
"You got a big mouth,"
Victor snarled, barely able to contain his rage. "Just trying to figure out what's wrong with you, Victor. You've been shooting your mouth off all day, acting like a world-class prick. We're all getting sick of it."
"I'm going to kick your ass,"
Victor howled as he hopped from one foot to the other like a boxer. Rapp didn't say a word. He moved to the middle of the mat and motioned for Victor to join him. Victor started whooping and hollering as he danced circles around Rapp. He was throwing shadow punches and explaining in detail what he was going to do to Rapp when suddenly one of the instructors reappeared in the doorway.
"What in hell are you ladies doing?"
Victor fell silent, but it was too late.
"That's it, you dumbasses. If you got enough energy to fight, then you've got enough energy to run. You've got 60 seconds to muster your worthless asses outside on the line. Put your running gear on and move it."
Everyone sprang into action, and while they were putting on their gear, the other 5 men made their displeasure known through a mix of looks and verbal complaints. Rapp did not respond, while Victor seemed to relish it. He turned the taunts back on the other men and invited any of them to take a shot at him just as soon as one of them grew a set of balls. Rapp put on his shoes and sprinted for the door. He was the first one on the line, and while he waited for the others, it occurred to him that something wasn't right. If this program was so secretive and elite, what in hell was a loudmouth like Victor doing here? Chapter 7. Camp Perry, Virginia. Tom Lewis took the call on the secure line. He listened patiently to the person on the other end relay a seemingly benign message about a meeting that was to take place in Washington, D.C. the following afternoon. To anyone with the ability to breach the secure system, which of course included the internal security people back in Langley, the conversation would have seemed so ordinary as to not warrant a second thought. In the third sentence, however, an adverb was used that caused his right eyebrow to shoot up a quarter inch. Lewis thanked the person on the other end and said they would talk at the meeting the next day. The clinical psychologist slowly placed the phone back in its cradle and tapped his pen on a generic desk blotter. Everything in the office was generic, all standard-issue government furniture, the kind that was purchased in massive quantities every year by the behemoth federal government. The desk, bookcase, and credenza were all made from particle board coated with a thin plastic veneer that was supposed to look like wood, but didn't. The chairs were black plastic with coarse charcoal fabric seats that could render a pair of dress pants useless in just 9 months. Lewis was amazed at how ubiquitous this type of furniture had become in Washington, which in turn led him to the conclusion that the maker of this substandard furniture was more than likely headquartered in the home district of the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Lewis detested such poor craftsmanship, but nonetheless made no attempt to add personal touch to this office. His private office was in the district, and every square inch of it had been meticulously decorated. With what he charged for an hour of therapy, he could not only afford the fine trappings, but even more, his clients expected it. In a rather short period of time, he had built up a very profitable practice. His patient list was a virtual who's who of Washington's power elite. Lobbyists, lawyers, and CEOs made up the bulk of his business. He treated only a smattering of politicians, but dozens of women who were married to powerful senators and congressmen came to see him every week and poured their hearts and minds out. If he were unscrupulous, he'd be able to use that information to his benefit, but he had never been tempted. The 36-year-old Lewis had both the passion and the natural inclination for his work. He had obtained an undergraduate degree in economics and math from Pomona College, and a graduate degree in clinical psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. The latter was paid for by the government, which required him to serve 4 years in the Army upon graduating. That stint in the Army, more than anything, was what pulled Lewis into this current situation, in a windowless, crappy office on a base that very few people even knew existed. It seemed he had a knack for spotting mental deficiencies, which when he was in the Army was something that greatly interested at least one flag officer and a couple of colonels down at Fort Bragg. He'd spent 3 years helping the Joint Special Operations Command tighten up their selection process and develop a new system for game theory. Lewis took a moment to collect his thoughts and figure out how the call would affect his evening. The camp had a bachelor's quarters of sorts for the various employees and consultants who traveled back and forth to D.C. When a new class was on the post, he normally stayed one or two nights a week so he could observe how they interacted. He had planned on staying the evening and spending some time with one of the recruits, who was showing some troublesome signs, but the phone call was more pressing. Lewis looked down at his World War II Elgin A-11 U.S. military watch. His father had given it to him on his deathbed 3 years earlier. Lewis had replaced the worn strap and kept the watch in near-perfect shape. It was 7:14 in the evening. Nothing on his desk was that urgent, and besides, it was a perfect evening to get out on the open road and clear his mind. He collected the two open files and spun his chair around to face a gray metal safe, which was already open. Lewis placed the files in the proper slot, closed the safe, and spun the dial. He left the office door open, as there was nothing other than the contents of the safe that needed to be protected. His motorcycle was parked in the first space in front of the building. Lewis took off his sport coat and tie and carefully folded and placed them on the seat. He unlocked one of the saddlebags of the BMW 1200 motorcycle and retrieved a gray and black leather riding jacket and a pair of chaps. He never rode his bike without them, even with the thermometer pushing 90 degrees. Imprinted on his brain was the road rash a friend had received when he'd been forced to lay his bike down on a hot California afternoon. The jacket and tie were placed in the saddlebag, and he put on his gray helmet. The motorcycle hummed to life, and Lewis climbed on. 60 seconds later, he tipped his visor at the sentry standing post at the main gate and blew past him. A minute after that, he was rocketing up the entrance ramp onto Interstate 64 and on his way north. The drive would take a bit more than an hour, which Lewis didn't mind in the least. No phones, no one knocking on his door, wanting him to listen to his problems. Lewis was finding it increasingly difficult to find the time to clear his mind and focus on the task at hand. A big green sign informed him how many miles he had to travel to reach Richmond, but he barely noticed. He was already thinking of their new recruit. That had to be why she had called. Lewis set the cruise control at 70 miles per hour, adjusted himself on the seat, and checked his mirrors. He considered how much work he had put into this one candidate. The man was as close to perfect as anyone they'd come across in the almost 2 years he'd been working on the program. Lewis leaned into a turn and wondered if it was possible for Hurley to run the kid out in one afternoon. Unfortunately, he knew the answer to that question, because he'd seen him do it on more than one occasion. Chapter 8. Lake Anna, Virginia. It was a moonless night sky, and all but a few of the exterior lights were off so as to not attract bugs. The mutts had just finished their run, and another 100 up and downs and a few more exercises designed to fatigue little-used muscles and maybe get one or more of them to quit so they could get down to the serious stuff. Unfortunately, all 7 were now filing into the barn in a manner not much different than that of cows returning from a day grazing in the pasture. Their heads were down, their pace was slow, and their footing unsure, and fortunately, the arguing was over. The only thing they could think about at the moment was sleep. Hurley took a sip of bourbon and looked out across the lawn. Despite the fact that it was his 7th in the past 3 hours, he was not drunk. When it came to booze, and a lot of other things, the spook had the constitution of a man 3 times his size. Tonight, however, his normally unshakable confidence was a little wobbly. Hurley was feeling a nagging indecision that, to the average person, was a daily occurrence, but to a headstrong, decisive man like him, was rare. The shiner on his eye and his throbbing headache were nothing more than a nagging physical symptom. A few more glasses of Maker's Mark, and they would be thoroughly dulled. The problem was between his ears, a crack in his psyche that had put him in a rarely visited but increasingly familiar place. It was gnawing at the back of his head, trying to crawl into his brain stem and take him down. The signs were all there: tight chest, quick breath, a sudden desire to get the hell out of Dodge and go somewhere, anywhere but here. For a man who was used to being in control, used to being right all the time, it was the most unwelcome feeling he could imagine. He'd rather get kicked in the head until he was knocked unconscious than try to wrestle with this crap. The fix, Hurley knew, involved something he still wasn't used to. He'd spent years burying his problems, patching them, hiding them under anything he could find. His job was too important. There were too many enemies to confront, and not enough men willing to do it. There was too much to do. The stakes were too high for him to sit around and feel sorry for himself. He was, after all, a product of the Cold War. While the children of the 60s cut loose and got in touch, Hurley cut throats and got as out of touch with his feelings as was possible. He darted around Europe in the late 50s and early 60s and then Southeast Asia in the mid-60s. The 70s brought him to South America, the early 80s to Central America, and then, finally, for the biggest shit show of all, he landed in the Middle East. The entire thing was a gigantic, multidimensional chess match with the Soviets, a continuation of what had happened at the end of World War I and then the aftermath of World War II. Getting in touch with his thoughts or feelings or whatever they were was not something Hurley relished. There was right and there was wrong. And in between, an abyss filled with society's whiners, people who had inherited the luxury of safety and freedom while having done nothing to earn it. He had never heard these opinions pass the lips of his mother or father. They didn't have to. He was born during the Depression. But they had lived through it. They'd moved from Chicago to Bowling Green, Kentucky, with their 5 kids to escape the long food lines and massive unemployment of the inner city. Hurley had come of age not knowing any better. His lot in life seemed just as good as the next kid's. He'd taken that stoic demeanor and joined the army. After serving a stint, he enrolled at Virginia Tech on the GI Bill and graduated with decent marks. That final spring, a man from the federal government who was extremely interested in his military record asked him if he'd like to see the world, asked him if he'd like to make a difference. Hurley bit. Officially, he'd spent the last 21 years darting in and out of war-torn countries and doing his part to create a few wars, too. Unofficially, it had been longer than that. He'd been on the very edge of the conflict between the Soviets and America and had no illusions about which side was the more noble of the two. All a person had to do was spend a little time in Berlin to understand the effects of communism and capitalism. Talk about a tale of two cities. East Berlin and West Berlin were living, breathing examples. Posters for the governments who had run them since the end of World War II. One side was a vivid Kodachrome film, and the other a grainy old black-and-white pile of crap. Hurley had never been more proud than when that damn wall came tumbling down. He'd spilled his own blood in the battle and had lost a few friends and more sources than he could count or wanted to remember. But they'd won. Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of time to enjoy their victory. Hurley and a few others already had their eyes on the jihadists. He'd come across them when he was helping bleed the Soviet Union of cash, equipment, manpower, and eventually the will to continue its despotic experiment. It had been in the Khyber Pass, and at first he saw nothing that made him nervous. These people wanted their land back and the Soviets out. The problem started with the religious zealots who were being shipped in from Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and a handful of other crappy little countries. Hurley loved to swear, drink, and chase women, which put him on a collision course with the Puritan fun-sucking Wahhabi jihadists from Saudi Arabia. He almost instantly developed a special dislike for them, but didn't understand back then that they would want to spread their jihad beyond the Jerkwater Mountains of Southwest Asia. That came later when he started to see them meddling in the affairs of the Palestinians. It was starting all over again. The Soviets had been contained and beaten, and now this new enemy was out pushing its agenda. Hurley had a bad feeling about where it was headed, and on top of that, for the first time in his life, he felt tired. This threat was not going away, and he suddenly wasn't sure he could find, let alone train, the next batch of kids who would be needed to meet the threat. He needed help. Unfortunately, asking for help was not something Hurley was good at. He heard one of the dogs bark, and then the sound of a motorcycle drifted through the pines. It was not the rumble of an American-made motorcycle, rather the purr of a Japanese or German bike. Hurley breathed a small sigh that was part relief, part resignation. It was the doc. He realized Kennedy must have called him. A single beam of light slashed through the trees, and a moment later the motorcycle coasted round the corner. The bike was so quiet, Hurley could hear the tires on the gravel driveway. The bike rolled its way up to the house, and the rider eased the kickstand into the down position and then killed the engine. After retrieving a flat piece of wood from one of the molded saddlebags, he put it under the kickstand and then took off his helmet. Thomas Lewis ran a hand through his shaggy blonde hair and looked up at Hurley. He immediately noticed the swelling over the eye, but he was more concerned with a look on the man's face that he had only recently grown to understand. "Tough day?" Hurley tried to laugh it off. "No easy days in this line of work, you know that." Lewis nodded. He knew all too well the toll that their business could inflict on a person, and not just the body. The physical injuries were fairly straightforward. They could either be mended or not. The assaults on the mind and soul were an entirely different matter. Chapter 9. Beirut, Lebanon. The battered, dusty Peugeot slowed to a crawl. The driver leaned out over the steering wheel and looked left and then right down the length of Hamra Street. His friend in the passenger seat did the same, but in a more half-hearted fashion. There was no stoplight, nor was there a stop sign, but habits formed during war died hard. Samir was the youngest of four brothers. Three of them had died in the civil war that had destroyed this once beautiful city. His closest brother, only 13 months his senior, had been killed by an RPG while crossing this very intersection. To the Westerners who covered the bloody civil war, Hamra Street was better known as the Green Line. Ali and his friends called it No Man's Land. It was the street that divided East and West Beirut, and, to a certain degree, the Muslims from the Christians, or more accurately, the Shiite Muslims from the Maronite Christians. There were neighborhoods on each side of the line where you could find pockets of Sunnis, Armenians, Greek Orthodox, and Druze. Some of these outposts were more exposed than others, and they had all but disappeared during the lengthy and savage civil war, while a few of the more entrenched ones were now rebuilding. The civil war in many respects resembled the mob warfare of Chicago in the 1920s, but with much bigger guns. With the war officially over for almost 2 years, virtually every part of the city was showing signs of life. The Christians to the east were rebuilding at a blistering pace, and the Muslims to the west were struggling to keep pace. Construction cranes dotted the skyline, and you were now more likely to get killed by a dump truck or a bulldozer than a sniper, at least in certain areas. Amra Street was not one of those areas. The buildings were still gutted shells, perfectly suited for a sniper to lie in wait. Samir scanned the building across the street to his left, while his friend Ali, who was sitting next to him, did the same thing to their right. "Still cautious," the man in the back seat said in a coarse voice. Samir looked sheepishly in the rearview mirror. "Sorry." Asif Syed nodded and took another drag from his cigarette. He remembered that Samir's brother had been killed not far from here. A lot of good men had been killed along this godforsaken stretch of road. Syed, however, did not make small talk with his men. Such familiarity led to their getting ideas. Ideas were not good. They only needed to follow orders. He also had no desire to get too close to the all but disposable men who worked for him. It was far easier to mourn the loss of someone you didn't know well than the loss of a close friend. Once Samir received the go-ahead from Ali, he gunned the engine and tore across the broad street, over the abandoned trolley tracks, and into a canyon of half-demolished buildings on the other side. A year or two earlier, he would have never dreamed of taking this shortcut. The car continued for 2 blocks, dodging piles of rubble, and then hung a sharp left turn. Building by building, block by block, things got better. The first sign was that the roads were clear of debris. Scaffolding and cement mixers were the next positive sign, and then, finally, they came upon a row of buildings that actually had windows, although the stone facades were pockmarked from artillery shells and small arms fire. 2 young men stood in front of a roadblock, AK-47 assault rifles at the ready. Samir slowed the car to a stop and looked at the young face of the man who was pointing the barrel of his rifle at his head. They were all young these days, or old, but there were very few in between. An entire generation had either fled the country or been killed. Samir jerked his thumb toward the back seat and watched the guard's eyes open wide as he recognized the ruthless Asif Syed. The young man gave a quick bow of respect and then ordered his colleague to move the barricade. The block was sealed at both ends. Some had started to question the manpower and effort that went into this, but all Syed had to do was flash them one of his withering stares, and they were silenced. The Syrian intelligence colonel was of the mind that this peace was more of a lull in the fighting, and the second they let their guard down, they would pay for it dearly. He continually advised the other militias to reconstitute, to find new recruits, and to train them diligently, and to use this lull in the fighting to stockpile arms and ammunition. With each passing month, it was becoming increasingly difficult to convince them to direct their resources to the next battle. To the men under his command, however, there was no questioning his orders. Syed had made certain of that by putting a bullet through the forehead of one of his aides at a staff meeting just 2 months earlier. Syed tossed his cigarette in the gutter and entered the office building. Extension cords ran along the floor and the wall to bring power to various levels. The place had been functional for just 2 weeks, and Syed did not plan to use it for more than another few days at the most. The greatest vulnerability for his side was a complete lack of air power. If some dog in Israel found out where he was, he could have jets scrambled and dropping bombs on him in less than 20 minutes. He took the stairs down to the basement level. The smell of raw sewage was an instant reminder that the city was still suffering the ills of almost 15 years of fighting. 2 men were in the hallway, standing next to a kerosene lamp. They were still without power in the basement. Without having to be told, the men moved away from the door. The older of the two snapped off a distinctly British salute.
"Colonel, it is good to see you."
Syed ignored the greeting. "Where is Colonel Jalil?" The man jerked his head toward the door.
"He is inside with the prisoner."
Syed motioned for him to open the door. The guard extended his hand. In it was a black hood.
"To hide your identity."
Syed gave him a disdainful look, and the man put the hood away and opened the door. A man sat naked in the middle of the room, tied to a metal chair. One man was standing beside him, another in front. Both were wearing black hoods. Syed entered the room and walked directly to the prisoner. He grabbed him by his hair and yanked his head up so he could see his face. Syed stood there searching the man's features for half a minute. So far he only had a trickle of dried blood on his upper lip. Other than that, he looked untouched.
"Who are you?" Syed asked.
"My name is Nihad Wasuf."
Syed stared at him for a long time and finally said,
"I think you are a liar. In fact, I think you are a Jew."
"No,"
the man protested vehemently.
"I am a Syrian."
"I doubt that.
I would not lie about such a thing. Check with the names I have given you."
Syed was already doing just that, but this man seemed like a rat to him, and those lazy fools back in Damascus could be tricked. Without warning, Syed walked over to a small cart. A variety of tools were lying on the surface. His hands danced from one to the next. He did not want to do anything that would require medical attention at this point. Finally, he settled on a pair of pliers. Syed walked back to the man and held the pliers in front of him.
"I am not as nice, nor am I as patient, as these two men. I will ask you only one more time. What is your real name?"
The man stammered for a second and then said,
"Nihad Wasuf."
Syed reached out and straightened the prisoner's forefinger on his left hand. He clamped the pliers down on the quarter inch of nail that extended beyond the tip of the finger and rocked it back and forth a few times. The prisoner began to squirm. A line of crimson blood appeared at the edge of the nail bed.
"Tell me your real name."
"I already have, I swear."
"Why are you looking for the American?"
"I was sent here to negotiate his release."
"By who?"
"His company."
"I think you are lying."
"No, I am not. Call my friends in Damascus. They will vouch for me."
"I do not believe you."
"Please, I am only a messenger. They are willing to pay a great sum of money."
"What if you are a spy?"
"I am not."
"Liar."
And with that, Syed tore the man's fingernail completely out of its bed. Chapter 10. Lake Anna, Virginia. The doctor peeled off his leather riding gear and stood on the porch, listening to Hurley recount the afternoon's events. He did so as passively as possible, even though his concern grew on several fronts. Interrupting, he'd learned with Hurley, was a bad approach. It was best to let him get it all out. Questions or comments could be perceived as a personal attack, which in turn would elicit a spirited counterattack, all of which the doctor knew was very counterproductive. Lewis had met the spook 5 years earlier. The Department of Defense had shipped his ODA team off to Pakistan to help the Black Ops boys from Langley, who were trying to train and equip the Mujahideen in the treacherous border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Hurley, in his typical gruff manner, had expressed his amusement that the vaunted Green Berets were now attaching shrinks to their units. He wondered if Lewis was similar to the political commissars who were attached to Red Army units, which was not exactly a compliment, since the communist officers were political appointees and in charge of Communist Party morale among the troops. They were also known to ship off to Siberia anyone who didn't show absolute devotion to the party. They were feared and despised by their own men. Lewis had read clean through the rough bravado of Hurley, and rather than take offense, he laughed along. As the weeks passed, however, Hurley began to consult the shrink with increasing frequency. Hurley soon learned the good doctor was a valuable asset to have around. Lewis, he found out, had a gift. He could read people. The doctor was a walking, talking polygraph. When Hurley was finished giving the afternoon's play-by-play, he didn't stop to hear the doctor's opinion or let him ask questions. He moved headlong into what he thought needed to be done. "I want you to sit down with him and run him through the ringer. Clear your calendar for the rest of the week if you have to. I want to know what the deal is with this kid. He's hiding something, and I want to know what it is." As was his habit, Lewis pursed his lips and stared off into the distance while he thought about other possibilities. He respected, liked, and felt a sense of loyalty to Hurley, but he was not exactly a well-balanced, mentally healthy adult male. Kennedy, on the other hand, was possibly one of the most measured and thoughtful humans he'd ever had the pleasure of working with. Before he did anything, he wanted to hear her side of the story. "I'll clear my schedule for tomorrow," Lewis said, agreeing without really agreeing. "Let's head inside. I'm starving, and I need to use the bathroom." After Lewis had relieved himself and washed his face, they found Kennedy at the kitchen table reading a file and picking at a plate of noodles. Lewis looked at the uninspired pasta and frowned. One of his passions was cuisine, and it pained him to watch his colleagues put so little effort into something so important. Without saying a word, he began searching the cupboards for something, anything that he could use to create a passable meal. Kennedy and Hurley shared a brief smile. Lewis stuck his nose into the refrigerator, and without bothering to turn around, said, "Stan, would you be so kind as to fetch a bottle of wine from the basement? A Chateau Dominique would be fine." He took out a package of chicken and closed the door. Moving to the sink, he paused for a brief moment and then said, "You might as well grab two." When Hurley was gone, Lewis looked over his shoulder at Kennedy and motioned for her to join him at the sink. "So," he said, "Stan's not exactly thrilled with your new recruit." "He's not the easiest man to please." Lewis turned on the water and began to rinse the chicken. With a wry smile, he said, "He thinks you set him up." Kennedy rolled her eyes. "This is the one you told me about, the kid from Syracuse?"
"Yes."
Lewis splayed the chicken open and let the water run through the crevices. "You never said anything about his fighting abilities." Kennedy sheepishly shrugged her shoulders and said, "I didn't know he had them." "That's a pretty big thing to miss." Lewis glanced up at her. "I'm not judging. I'm not proud that I missed it, but in the end, isn't it a good thing?"
"Maybe. Maybe not."
Kennedy explained what she knew about rap, which admittedly wasn't a great deal. But she pointed out yet again that a blank slate was not necessarily a bad thing, that they could mold him into the man they needed. She finished her verbal report as Hurley made it back up from the basement. Lewis asked her to prepare a small salad while he went to work boiling noodles and slicing up the chicken and preparing a creamy white sauce. Hurley was left to open the red wine. While Lewis put the finishing touches on the main dish, Hurley and Kennedy started up again. They volleyed back and forth, each one putting forth his or her version of what had happened and how the other one had screwed up. Like any good shrink, Lewis was a good listener, and he played his part. It helped that these two were rarely boring. Hurley was a once-in-a-lifetime patient, the kind of man who was so outrageously entertaining that you sometimes felt you should pay him rather than the other way around. Sure, there was a flourish of exaggeration here and there, but Lewis had witnessed several of his exploits firsthand and knew the stories to be for the most part accurate. Kennedy was very different. There was no cussing or anger or animated hand gestures accompanied by thespian-like facial contortions. There was just a calm, analytical, intellectual way about her that put you at ease. Her answers were never rushed and almost always thoughtful. She did not participate in personal verbal attacks or attempt to sway opinion by exaggeration. Wildly different in almost every way, they did share a few qualities that served to exacerbate the situation. Both were deeply suspicious of everyone they encountered, and did not find it easy to admit they were wrong. On top of that, their long history and familiarity served to bring both the best and worst qualities to the surface in a very raw way. Lewis would never admit this to them, but it had become one of his great clinical joys watching these two argue. It was a verbal combat at an Olympian level. The table was set, the wine poured, and the food dished up. Kennedy picked at her salad while Hurley and Lewis devoured both the salad and the chicken and tomato fettuccine. Lewis ate in near silence while he watched the two joust. He interrupted on three occasions, but only for clarification. When he'd cleaned his plate and poured himself a second glass of wine, he pushed his chair back and was ready to give them his take on the matter. One of the things they had decided at the formation of the group was that they wanted Lewis to have full operational input. Hurley was in charge, but there was some apprehension in Washington over his cowboy attitude. Hurley, to his credit, understood that he had certain weaknesses. Rather than cop an attitude about Lewis's role expanding beyond weeding out the whack jobs, Hurley had told him, "I don't want any bullshit, PC, shrink stuff. You're paid to voice your opinions, not give me an endless stream of what-ifs." With that in mind, Lewis put his glass down and said, "Two mistakes were made, and you both know what they were." Kennedy nodded, while Hurley said, "I can think of one. Her not doing her due diligence. What's the second one?" "You can't think of a single thing you did wrong today?" Lewis asked. "I'm not perfect, but this one's not my fault," Hurley pointed at Kennedy. "I am busier than shit trying to see which one of these boys has the right stuff. I'm not responsible for the turds she dumps in my lap." Lewis was suddenly resigned to the fact that he would have to box Hurley in a little tighter. Clearing his throat, he said, "We're left with two options. Either this kid is really good, or you're losing a step." Lewis took a drink and asked, "Which one is it?" Hurley's jaw tightened. "I haven't lost a step." In a slightly embarrassed voice, he added, "I just underestimated him, that's all." "And that's what worries me the most," Lewis said in an accusatory tone. "Don't worry. I won't let it happen again. I'm afraid that's not good enough." Hurley lit a cigarette and casually said, "Let's not make this into something bigger than it needs to be." "Bullshit," Lewis said with genuine fury. "Come on," Hurley said, trying to shrug the whole thing off. "Don't come on me. You fucked up today, and you fucked up big time." Kennedy leaned back, her eyes wide, unable to hide her surprise at Lewis's strong condemnation. "Let's not overreact," Hurley said easily, trying to take some of the heat out of the conversation. "Overreact?" Lewis leaned forward. "I'm not sure it would be possible to overreact to this situation, and what is really bothering me is that you know it, but you're too pig-headed to admit it. It's not the end of the world." Lewis's indignation was growing with each denial. "You're supposed to be infallible. These guys are supposed to fear you, loathe you, hate your fucking guts, but the one thing they are never supposed to do is lay a shiner on you." Lewis pointed at Hurley's swollen eye. "And they definitely aren't supposed to beat you, especially not 5 minutes after they've walked through the gate."
"He didn't beat me," Hurley growled.
"Well, that's debatable. From what I've heard, he had you beat, and the only way you got out of it was by cheating."
"Yeah, well, life's not fair."
"At this stage, Stan, these guys are like young pups, you know that. When we lay down the rules, we can't break them. It sends the wrong signal."
Hurley leaned back and stubbornly folded his arms across his chest.
"I was suckered into this thing."
"I'm not sure you were, but for a moment I'll go along with you."
Lewis paused briefly and then said, "You're not supposed to get suckered. You're supposed to run these dogs until they're so tired they can barely stand. You're supposed to watch them go after each other, get a sense of what they're capable of, and then you're supposed to bring them into that barn and smack them down, just like when you and I went through boot camp. This is delicate work, goddammit, and you know it. There's a reason why we do things the way we do them, and your ego has no place in the decision process."
"My ego has nothing to do with this,"
Hurley shot back with a sour look on his face. "I just let my guard down, that's all."
"No,"
Lewis shook his head. "I'm inclined to agree with Irene on this one. You still see her as a little girl, and you don't give her the credit she deserves. She shows up with this new recruit, and because he doesn't fit into your little box of where these recruits are supposed to come from, you decided to skip steps 1, 2, and 3, kick his ass, and send him packing."
Lewis sat back, took a drink of wine, and then in a calmer voice asked, "Does it mean anything to you that Thomas signed off on this?" Lewis was referring to the deputy director of operations. Embarrassed, Hurley said, "I didn't think of that."
"Do you understand the situation you've created?"
Hurley didn't react at first, and then, very slowly, he began to nod. Kennedy was feeling better about her position, but she wasn't entirely sure what they were talking about, and asked Lewis, "What do you mean by situation?"
"These things have a way of spinning out of control," Lewis said. "One recruit has some success putting a shiner on an instructor, and all of a sudden the rest of them think that maybe they can take a shot. That these guys are human. Throw in the fact that Stan here had to cheat to avoid losing, and we now have a potentially dangerous situation."
"How so?" Kennedy asked.
"Do you think it's in our best interest to train your boy, send him off, and have him decide that when things get tough, the rules don't really matter?"
Kennedy now saw the point.
"Fuck," Hurley mumbled to himself.
"What do you want me to do?"
"You're going to get the hell out of here for about 5 days. I want you to heal up. You let me and the others run these guys down, I'll get a better sense of this rap kid and his full potential.
And then?
You come back here and you head into the barn with him, and you beat him fair and square."
"And if he can't beat him?" Kennedy asked.
Lewis and Hurley shared a look. They were in uncharted waters. Lewis finally looked at Kennedy and said,
"That would be a nice problem to have."
Chapter 11. The first night didn't go so well, at least as far as sleep was concerned. Victor had kept all of them up, telling outrageous stories of his sexual conquests, each one more graphic and bizarre than the already twisted story he'd just finished. After an hour or so, he ran out of steam and called them all a bunch of faggots for not reciprocating. Victor then proceeded to launch into a symphony of unabated flatulence for a quarter of an hour, before eventually falling into a deep, snorting slumber. Rap placed his pillow over his head and tried to block out the noise, but it didn't work. It was in those much-needed sleepless hours just after midnight when Rap began to explore the idea of getting rid of Victor. At first he considered getting up and throttling the idiot, right then and there, but knew it would only result in further punishment from the instructors and disdain from his fellow recruits. Still, the thought of spending the next 6 months with the lout was something that presented a very real problem. A guy like Victor could easily drag someone down with him, and Rapp had an undeniable feeling that the two men were on a collision course, and not one of those collisions that could be avoided if one or both of them changed their behavior. It was inevitable. It was the kind you needed to brace yourself for. Either drop your hips, lower your shoulders, and make the other guy feel more pain than you, or he would do the same to you when you were toast. There was something undeniably odd about the man. The idea of his participating in a covert op was preposterous. If he could ever walk among the enemy undetected, it would be a miracle. Rapp wanted this new vocation with every fiber of his body, although he was smart enough to know that saying he would never quit and actually never quitting were two very different things. He also knew he would be tested in ways he'd never imagined. He'd be pushed to the full extent of his physical and mental abilities, and it was likely that at some point, when he was really in the hurt bag, that pang of doubt would creep into his mind. Could Victor create a climate in which, at his lowest point, he might consider quitting? Rapp didn't want to find out. Somewhere in the middle of the night, as he was lying on his back, watching bats dart around the rafters of the barn, and listening to the snorting Victor, Rapp decided the moron would need to quit. And if he didn't do it on his own, and do it quickly, Rapp would have to find a way to subtly nudge him in the right direction. They were up before the sun. Two of the instructors came in and cursed, yanked, kicked, and slapped them out of bed. Luckily for Rapp, he was half awake and heard the door open. His feet were on the floor before the DI could dump him out of his cot. He'd guessed this was how the morning would start, but the yelling was nonetheless unsettling. In between the barking and smacking, Rapp tried to make out exactly what it was that he was supposed to do. Somewhere in the middle of it, he heard the words line and PT. He threw on his workout gear and running shoes and was out the door like a shot. The lawn was covered with a thick morning dew, and the sun was only a gray veil in the east. They weren't allowed watches, and there were no clocks in the barn, so Rapp guessed that it was somewhere in the vicinity of 5 a.m. The air temp had to be in the mid-70s, and the humidity was pasty. It would be another hot one.
As Rapp came to a stop in the line, he was aware that he was the first and only one out the door. He figured to start with, there were certain things where it was smart to be first and others where it wasn't. Getting out of bed and getting on the line was an area to be first. Hand-to-hand combat and fighting drills, he would never hold back on, but the endurance stuff like running and PT, he would. He needed to stay healthy and hold some things in reserve. These guys didn't need to know he could run like the wind. As he waited for the others, he caught a whiff of coffee and turned to look at the house. There, standing on the porch, was a new face, a blond-haired guy who looked to be in his mid-30s. The man was staring intently at Rapp. Rapp returned the stare, and even at a distance of several hundred feet, noted the blue eyes. The guy was in a pair of jeans and a T-shirt. He was leaning against one of the porch columns, sipping his coffee, and making no effort to conceal his interest in Rapp. There was something different about the guy. Rapp could tell he was in shape, but he was way more relaxed than the other DIs who were marching around, and that sadistic little cuss who'd tried to neuter him. One by one, the guys tricked out of the barn and fell in. Victor was last, which was becoming a common theme. Sergeant Smith was walking quickly beside him, giving him an earful in a hushed voice. They had all been warned that there would be no yelling on the line. This wasn't the only place on the lake, and voices carried across the water. Inside the barn, with the door closed, however, the decibel level went through the roof. Victor fell in at the far end from Rapp. Sergeant Smith stepped out in front of the seven recruits and with a clenched jaw said, "You buds better get your shit together, or I'm going to start knocking some heads. I've seen Cub Scouts do better than this. This is damn sloppy. It shouldn't never take you morons more than 60 seconds to get your ass out of bed, dressed, and on the line. When you go to bed, you make sure your shit is ready. You lay it out on your footlocker so it's ready to go. We start PT at 5 every morning." Rapp watched the DI's eyes shift to the opposite end of the line. He leaned forward and saw Victor had his arm raised. "Sarge, when are we supposed to take a piss? I gotta go so bad I'm about to drown." Sergeant Smith walked over to Victor and got in his face. "Maybe if you had gotten your lazy ass out of bed when I told you to, you would have had time to piss." He stepped back and looked down the line. "We're going to do a quick warm-up. As much as I hate you idiots, the powers that be don't want you ladies getting hurt until they see if you've got some potential. I have tried to dissuade them, as you are the biggest collection of shit-lickers I've seen come through here in some time." "Sarge, I gotta go real bad," Victor whined. "And piss yourself, you big idiot." His head snapped to the group. "If you can't take care of your business and get out here in 60 seconds, I'm going to have to treat you like a bunch of toddlers. So go ahead and piss yourself, Victor. The rest of you who need to go, I suggest you wait until we head out for our run. You can pull over on the trail and take care of business. Now drop and give me 50, and if I see any of you pussies cheating, we'll start over." They did the 50 push-ups, followed by 100 sit-ups, 50 up-downs, and then a few minutes of scissor kicks and a couple of stretches, and then Sergeant Smith led them into the woods. 8 of them in a nice, neat line, with Victor trailing. Rapp guessed they were moving at just under a 6-minute pace. He could keep a 5-minute pace for 10 miles, so he was feeling good. They finished the 5-mile run and found themselves standing in front of an obstacle course in the middle of the woods. The place looked like a relic from an abandoned Renaissance festival. Sergeant Smith had his stopwatch out and was clocking them. Rapp positioned himself 5th in line, carefully placing one man between himself and Victor. He wanted to see how these other 4 guys navigated the course, guessing that they'd all done it when they'd gone through boot camp. His idea kind of fell apart when Sergeant Smith started sending guys at 30-second intervals. The course started with a low wall. It was a 10-foot-tall wood, moss-laden wall with 2 telephone poles stuck in the ground in front of it. The first telephone pole stuck out of the ground about 1.5 feet and was 4 feet in front of the wall. The next telephone pole was 2 feet in front of the wall and stuck out of the ground 3 feet. Rapp watched as the first recruit headed for the wall, picking up speed. Right before the telephone poles, he did a quick stutter step, and then, as nimbly as you could imagine, he placed his left foot on the first and shorter telephone pole, using it as a step. His right foot then landed on the second telephone pole, and he launched himself up and onto the wall, grabbing the top with both hands and pinning his knee to the wall just a few feet from the top. It was like a controlled collision. The recruit was up and over, dropping to the soft ground on the other side. The second guy did it the same way, and the third tried something slightly different that involved doing a pull-up. After the low wall was a 40-foot dash to a 15-foot high wall with ropes hanging on the face. There was nothing fancy about this one. You just grabbed the rope, put your feet on the wall, and walked your way up. Next in line was barbed wire. Again, pretty straightforward. Dive under, keep your butt down, and do an infantry crawl to the other end. After that was a 40-foot cargo net strung between two towering pines. Beyond this was a set of logs set up in a zigzag pattern about 3 feet off the ground. They acted as a sort of footbridge to test your balance. Rapp didn't have a chance to see what came after the balance logs because it was his turn to start. He quickly dried the palms of his hands on his shorts, and then, when Sergeant Smith gave him the signal, he ran toward the short wall, mimicked the exact steps of the first recruit, and threw himself up and at the top of the wall. He caught it, pulled himself up and over, and landed with ease on the other side. The second, taller wall was easy enough to navigate, and the barbed wire was about as primal as it got. If a guy couldn't grasp the simplicity of crawling, he should just quit and go home. The cargo net proved to be the first real challenge. About a third of the way up, Rapp realized there was too much slack in the middle, so he moved over to the side. After that, it was easier. The balance logs were a breeze, the tires were nothing, and the transfer ropes were playground 101. Then he came across something that looked like a set of uneven parallel bars, like the kind female gymnasts use. He paused, not sure how to attack the two horizontal telephone poles, and then, almost on cue, one of the DIs was right there barking orders at him, telling him what to do and to do it quickly. Based on what the DI was telling him, it sounded like a great way to break a rib. But Rapp could see no other way, so he launched himself into the first pole and then the second, and then it was more tires and a thing called the Burma Bridge. After that, there were more logs, ropes, and walls to negotiate, and a sprint to the finish. When Rapp crossed the line, Sergeant Smith was staring at his stopwatch and shaking his head. He glanced at Rapp, contempt on his face, and said, "You suck!" Rapp was doubled over with his hands on his knees, acting more tired than he was. He wanted to smile, but didn't. He couldn't have done that badly. The guy in the number six position had yet to finish. Rapp turned to see how the last two were doing. At the edge of the course, about 50 yards back, he saw the blonde-haired guy he'd seen on the porch earlier in the morning. The man was standing at the edge of the woods, staring straight at him, making no effort to conceal his interest. Chapter 12. Langley, Virginia. Kennedy parked in the east lot and entered the headquarters building at exactly 8:03. She'd used the hour-and-a-half drive up from Lake Anna to try to prioritize her ever-increasing list of responsibilities, both official and unofficial. Much of her job was off the books, and that meant no notes and no files. She had to keep it all organized in her own mind, and every time she came back to HQ, she needed to have her story straight. When the elevator doors parted on the sixth floor, one of her bosses was waiting with a deeply concerned look on his face. Max Powers nudged her back into the elevator and said, "Problem." Powers was the Near East Division chief. It had taken Kennedy a while to get used to his style. Powers was famous for speaking in one-word sentences. His colleagues who had worked with him over the years called him Musket Max. Kennedy stepped back and asked, "What's wrong?" Her immediate fear, as it was almost every time she entered the building, was that her black ops program had been uncovered. "Beirut," Powers said, offering nothing more. Beirut could mean a lot of things, but on this hot August morning, Kennedy was aware of one thing in particular. "John?"
"Yep."
"Crap," Kennedy mumbled under her breath. John Cummins was one of their deep cover operatives who had snuck into Lebanon 3 days earlier. An American businessman who worked for a data storage company had been kidnapped the previous week. This company, it turned out, was run by a Texan with big contacts in D.C. The owner was old-school, former Army, and over the past 30 years, he had freely and enthusiastically kept the CIA and the Pentagon abreast of all the info he and his people happened to pick up in their international dealings. A lot of very important people in town owed him, and he decided now was time to call in a few of his IOUs. The Pentagon had zero assets in the region, and the CIA wasn't much better. They were still trying to recover from the kidnapping, torture, and death of their Beirut station chief half a decade earlier.